You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
What's up, folks?
And joining us as a special rogue this week, George Robb. George, great to see you, man.
Hello, gentlemen.
Jay George. Is off again George. This week, but George was kind enough to step in at the last minute.
How's everyone? Everyone good? Everything okay?
Getting ready for Nexus coming up.
Yeah,
we are within 2 weeks, and I cannot wait.
Yep.
Yeah, George, you're doing the extravaganza with us. You're going to be the MC.
Yes, once again, our East Coast debut, or debut. Either way.
Yeah.
Debut.
And we got Bill Nye with us this time, which is...
Oh, that's
that?
Right.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Science man. Robert Nye, science man.
George, tell us, what's new with you? What else is new with you, George?
Oh, gosh. It's funny. The week of Nexus, I'm actually flying to London on that Wednesday. This will be the first time I get to do like... I'm flying for one day. This is crazy. My friend Milton Mermakaitis is putting on a show. He's celebrating the 10th year of his surviving leukemia. He's putting on a rebirthday show. He calls it his rebirthday. It's his 10th rebirthday. He's doing a fundraising show featuring a whole bunch of guitarists, English guitarists. And he asked me to come play drums, and I said, absolutely. So Tuesday night, I fly out. I land Wednesday morning. I do the show Wednesday night. And then Thursday, I fly back to the States, and we do our Nexus show Friday night. I love weekends like that. I can't wait. It's going to be very exciting. Yes, I will be awesome. A complete zombie. But the most fun creative stuff happens when you're just in that kind of state of having no idea what time it is, what day it is, where you are. I can't wait.
Do you want me to slap you around a little bit when I see you in New York?
Why should this be any different than any other time, Steve?
Okay.
Slap away.
Well, what's different is I'm asking you first this time.
Oh, okay. I appreciate it. Yes, absolutely. Yes, you have carte blanche to slap away. And let me say, while I just have a second here, I know at show 500, I mentioned my friend Alyssa, and people, your listeners, sent in so many wonderfully generous emails. I have to say thank you to everybody that sent them in. They were so incredible. I got hundreds of emails. I mean, hundreds of emails.
Awesome.
I put them all into a book. I gave them to Alyssa. She was overwhelmed. She didn't even know what to, it didn't even really register that this was, you know, emails from all over the United States, Canada, France, England, Australia, New Zealand, Nigeria, Japan. The reach of you guys is so wonderful, and I just am so grateful and thankful, and it's been really great. It lifted her spirits, and she's doing as well as can be expected. So she says thank you, and I say thank you. So thank
you. Great.
Good to hear. Nice.
Well, Bob, we have apparently 6 forgotten superheroes of science this week.
Yeah, this one was fun. It's not one person, but a group of them. The first programmers of ENIAC, the first electronic general-purpose computer, were 6 women. I did not know this. They are Kathleen McNulty Markley Antonelli, Jean Jennings Bartik, Frances Snyder Holberton, Marilyn Westhoff Meltzer. God, they all have 3 names. Frances Bylis Spence and Ruth Lichterman Teitelbaum. Ever hear of them? I had not. And no. they actually languished in obscurity for over 50 years, until the 1980s when they were rediscovered. When the U.S. Army decided to create, ENIAC, they realized that they needed people to program it. So they looked at a pool of 80 women computers, and that's what they were called. They were called computers in that day.
As in
the mid 40s. Yes.
Things.
Person
yes.
who computes. Yes. And, they were calculating during World War II, ballistic trajectories using complex differential calculations. So they were smart, very bright, of course, knew their stuff. They, in the mid 40s, they picked 6 of these women. 6 of the women that stood out extra, you know, just a little bit extra than some of the others. And, so like I said, ENIAC was the first all-electronic programmable computer.
Bob, what does ENIAC stand for?
Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer.
Yes. What he said. That's what it stands for. So now ENIAC
was. Also known
as
ENIAC.
ENIAC was three orders of magnitude faster than pretty much the best electromechanical computers of the day. It also had general purpose programmability. So those two facts, more than any else, made this a cutting edge and very exciting project for scientists, industrialists, just anybody kind of in the know. It was big. So these women learned to program it. And remember, they had no programming languages to help them. They had no programming tools or even manuals because they weren't invented yet. They just did not exist. So all they had to go by were these complex logical diagrams. That's what they had to use to program this thing. It was fiendishly complex. It was able to compute the complex ballistic trajectories in seconds when they were done. In seconds. This was thousands of times faster than these equations have ever been run before. It was quite extraordinary. Yet, when the Army showed ENIAC to the public, they introduced the male hardware designers, of course, but the programmers were not even mentioned. And that was a big day when they unveiled this to the public. It was like an all-day event. It took a while. All day, there was just no mention of them at all. They were essentially lost to history until 1985 when they were rediscovered by a woman programmer who was kind of feeling kind of anxious that women in her field just kind of slowly dropped out as they got to more and more higher level programming classes. And she's like, wow, what is the future for me? And she saw this picture of these women and were like, who are these women? Nobody knew. Even computer historians had no idea. They assumed that the women in the picture were just what they called them, refrigerator women, which meant that they were just kind of like models that were just placed there, to look good.
Price is right models.
Right. Exactly. But he was wrong. They went through much, much research and found out who these women were, interviewed them, fascinating stories. And even after the project, many of these women devoted themselves to making programming easier and making programming known to others and accessible to others. It really helped lay the foundation, for the programming marvels that are done today. Historically, men have essentially always been at the forefront of hardware design. But when it came to software, they had less respect for it. They thought it would be easy. So therefore they kind of like, oh, let's have the women do this thing kind of. And they didn't realize that programming is as instrumental and as important as hardware design. It's incredibly important. And these women took a commanding role like Ada Lovelace, which I mentioned last month or so, and even Lieutenant Grace Hopper. These women and the others went out there and just laid the foundation for programming as it is today. So, and these six ENIAC women were even less known, much less well known than Ada or Lieutenant Grace Hopper, but they still showed that programming is critical as hardware design. And so in 1997, these six women who did most of the programming for ENIAC were inducted into the Women in Technology International Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So guys, remember these women? Antonelli, Bartek, Holberton, Meltzer, Spence, and Teitelbaum. Mention them to your friends. Perhaps when you're discussing plug board wiring and 10-way switches on portable function tables, especially then.
And remind them that that's not a law firm.
Yes, it's not.
Whenever someone talks about women not being good at math and science and numbers, those names should be tattooed on that person's forehead.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of these women were mathematicians. That's what
that's that, awesome. Absolutely. And they're the tip of the iceberg. I mean, many of the women I've discussed are just brilliant. I mean, it's just even silly to contemplate the idea that they can't be as adept as anybody else. It's silly to even think about.
Now, you say programming, these computers, which they were doing, but they weren't writing code. They were flipping switches.
Flipping switches, plugging things in, changing wires. It was a fiendishly complex and mind-numbing process. You had to know what you were doing exactly, why you were doing it, how everything interrelated. It was incredibly tough. And that hardship that they went through, they were among the people that helped lay the foundation, to make it easier. And they were actually the only people ever to program the ENIAC at that low machine level, because it didn't take too long after them that they went to higher level languages that were at least still difficult as hell, but not as difficult as doing all this stuff.
Here's an observation. I was reading a little bit about this, Bob, and they started work on it in July of 1943. Obviously, this is the
on ENIAC, middle sure? of world.
Yeah, well, the construction contract was signed June 5, 1943. Work on the computer okay. began in secret University of Pennsylvania's Moore School of Electronic Engineering a month later. And yeah. then, so it, with that time, I imagine that part of the reason why women were recruited to do this job, you know, because we were in the war and the women had to kind of, in a lot of areas of technological advancement in the country, had to step up and, you know, take jobs that would have, might other been reserved strictly for men, especially something like this. So it was kind of the right people in the right time of it all coming together and doing something really fantastic. And, you know, it's fortunate that these women were able to do this work.
Yeah. I think that actually they started working on ENIAC, though. It was after the war. At least a couple of my sources mm-hmm. mentioned that it was after the war. I believe during the war, they were actually doing they were
the
working
computing.
As calculators, yeah. the computing being working as computer people.
Guys, are you familiar with the Titius-Bode law?
Yes.
Oh, that's the
yes.
one where you can't
the planets wait where the planets are
for the signal light to turn green before you cross the street.
Now, the spacing like of that. Planets, right? Where you would likely to find planets.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah, yeah. So the observation was first made by Titius, and then the math was worked out by Bode. For a long time, I just saw Bode's law, but now I've seen references to Titius-Bode law. So that's correct. Recently, there were a number of headlines which caught my eye, where the headlines were saying that scientists claim that that most stars in our galaxy would have Earth-like planets around. I'm very interested in where things are headed in our exoplanet exploration. So you guys know how many confirmed exoplanets we have? George, what do you think? How many confirmed exoplanets?
Oh, it's like 1,800, 2,000, something like that.
Very good. 1,821.
Yeah, there we go.
You were off by 21.
Yeah, 1821. So confirmed means that they've observed at least a couple of orbits or depending on the technique that's being used. So there's lots of candidate, thousands of more, you know, a couple of thousand more candidate exoplanets that haven't been confirmed yet. So that number is definitely going to go up. And then we have new projects coming online to look for more planets around other stars. So what the researchers did was they looked at systems where we had six or more exoplanets have been identified in those stellar systems. And they looked at the spacing of the planets to see if they conformed to Bode's law, this ratio of spacing between the planets. And then for those systems where they did fit the spacing, they calculated where the missing planets would be. You know, so in other words, you know, again, in 1778, Bode worked out the math where specifically you take the series 0, 3, 6, 12, 24. So, you know, you start with 0 and then 3, then you double the number every time. 24, 48, 96. Then you add 4 to each number and divide by 10. And that gives you a reasonable approximation of the distance to each of the planet in astronomical units. If you count the asteroid belt as a planet, it actually works out pretty well. The question has always been, is this real or is this numerology, right? Is this just
coincidence?
Yeah. Is there some physical law that is spacing out the planets this way or that we just haven't figured out? Or maybe it's some probability law or whatever. There's something going on there. Or is this just, you know, planets are going to be spaced out so they don't bump into each other and you're going to be able to fit some sequence to that. It's just from that point forward, it's just numerology. Some people point out the fact that if you look at the moons in our system, they don't really comport to Bode's law. Or you have to do modifies. This is where it gets like Texas sharpshooter type fallacy. You have to do like modified Bode's law. You have to, it works out if you put some kind of variation in there. It's like, yeah, but that's the whole point. If you have to put some kind of a modifier in there or variable.
Not really a law.
Yeah, then it's like you're just, all you're saying is things tend to be spaced out. You know, and then you're going to fit some kind of mathematical series to it. But if you give yourself enough wiggle room, it becomes meaningless, basically.
When I hear laws, I think laws of planetary motion,
Yeah, those are precise.
Sort of exact.
Yeah. Did Bode's Law predict extra solar system planets that weren't discovered at the time?
I think the asteroid belt was the one that really caught everyone's attention. So they said, well, yeah, we're missing this one planet where they're between Mars and Jupiter. And then, there actually is a planet's worth of material in the asteroid belt with Ceres and Vesta and then all the other asteroids. So that was the one real prediction that it made.
Okay.
And that's why probably we still know about it, and just every, it seems like every generation there are astronomers and people who want to find like the version of Bode's Law or the reason for it. Just there's something very tantalizing about this idea that there's this mathematical precision to the spacing of the planets. It's just a very sexy idea that won't go away, but it's, the fact that it's remained controversial for centuries tells you something too. So in any case, what the paper did was they used one of these, a generalized version of Bode's Law, which to me is janky, right? That tells me, so you're just basically fudging it. If you're fudging it to make it work. And then they said, okay, if we do that and then we calculate where the missing planets would be, look, we should have an Earth-like planet in the Goldilocks zone in most systems. So that's how they came to that conclusion. But I think that's extremely misleading. I mean, they weren't coming to that conclusion by actually counting planetary systems, where we're confirmed exoplanets, for example. So I don't think that you can, their analysis to me seemed like almost pure speculation. There's a lot of ifs in there. Is this generalized version of Bode's Law, valid? We're missing so many data points. We don't even really know if, we don't even really have enough data points in terms of exoplanets in other systems to know if it's really holding up or not. I mean, that would be the real test of Bode's Law, right? Once we have made enough observations where we could say, all right, we've found every planet in 100 systems, then we could see if Bode's Law predicts the spacing out of those planets, but they probably don't. And then you have to, use a tweaked version of Bode's Law, which then just becomes pattern recognition, and kind of becomes meaningless. Interestingly, at the same time, the new paper has been released looking at exosystems, exoplanets around other stars, and trying to answer the question of how planets get to where they are. Specifically, how our system got to the way it was by looking at the way other systems form. It seems like different stellar systems can fall into one of several different types of stable patterns. What's really interesting is that if you have a large planet like Jupiter that forms usually far away from the sun, from its parent star.
At least initially.
Yeah, usually initially, they tend to spiral in and get closer and closer to their star. And when they do that, they're going to throw all of the inner planets either into their star or out of the system. They're going to disrupt the orbits. So you'll end up with a system with a hot Jupiter, right? A Jupiter-sized, Jovian planet orbiting close to its star, but no inner rocky small worlds because no worlds in the Goldilocks zone. One estimate I read was that maybe 10% of the systems out there have fallen to that category. But again, we don't really know. It's too early to say. What happened in our system was that the Jupiter started to spiral in, probably. This is what the paper is saying. But then Saturn dragged it back out into its current stable orbit. And so when Jupiter started to spiral into the sun, it got rid of all of the inner planets. And then once the orbit of Jupiter was stabilized where it currently is, that new smaller rocky worlds formed. That's Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. So that's another stable system, but that's pretty rare because you need to have a Jovian world like Jupiter and then a slightly smaller Jovian planet like Saturn farther out. If Saturn were bigger than Jupiter, then it would be the planet that would dominate gravitationally. So you need to have that precise configuration. You need to have a Jupiter and a Saturn that sort of clears the way for small Earth-like inner planets to form. There's still a lot of speculation here, but this is how the scientists are putting it together. The third possibility is that there are no outer Jovian planets, or they're so far out they never spiral in. And then what you have is an inner solar system with many more planets, and essentially a lot more planetary matter survives in the inner solar system. So you have more planets and larger planets, and those are the systems where you get lots of super Earths. Earths are planets that are bigger than Earth, but smaller than Neptune.
Time for them to accrete to be truly massive proportions.
If it wasn't for Jupiter, Earth potentially would have been larger than it currently is.
Or some other planet that was larger would have been here, and Earth would have just been absorbed into that planet. Yeah.
I see.
Or the stuff that made the Earth would have been absorbed into those larger planets. Exactly. So that's interesting, you know, that we're starting to get a feel for, oh, look, there's different ways in which solar systems reach a stable point, you know, only one of which is our system, and it may actually be a very uncommon one. You may find many more systems that either have hot Jupiters that wiped out their inner solar system, or super Earths, you know, in the inner stellar system, but not a lot of smaller Earth-sized planets in the Goldilocks zone. So it's obviously very interesting in whether or not we're going to have Earth-sized planets in the Goldilocks zone where you have liquid water, because those are the ones that are most likely to have life that we would recognize, or planets that would be nice to colonize in a few thousand years. So I'm waiting the day when we have enough data points where we could really start to make some statistical statements about what typical stellar systems, planetary systems are like. But I don't think that Bode's law is going to be playing a big role. That's my hunch.
Yeah. Doesn't bode well.
Despite all the headlines declaring otherwise.
It's just saying that there may be space for those places, for those planets.
I mean, it just basically derives from the fact that planets are going to be basically spaced out.
You know,
they're not going to be on top of each other. That's it.
But it's kind of like saying, you know, Manhattan is 6 miles long, so there's bound to be a parking spot.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah,
and it's like no, that don't assume that at all.
Yeah. All right. Evan, I understand that scientists have discovered the largest asteroid impact zone on Earth ever discovered.
Oh, they have, and it's made the headlines recently, and it's big. So we're all familiar, perhaps, with Meteor Crater in Arizona, and the photographs of it. It's sort of the iconic image that you get in your mind when you think of an impact crater, you know, in the deserts of Arizona. You've got this nice sort of perfect impact crater that's roughly a little less than a mile from side to side in diameter. Well, imagine that, but make it 250 times larger than Meteor Crater. And what you have, as you said, and as the headlines are telling us, the largest impact crater ever discovered in Australia. And so a long time ago, in a galaxy very, very close to us, ours, a huge meteorite, we're talking huge, entered Earth's atmosphere. This thing was probably anywhere from maybe 10 to 12 miles across.
Oh boy.
We're talking just an absolute planet killer kind of event that happened. What had happened is it split. It split before it made impact with the Earth into two massive, massive pieces. Bam, bam. And it created a twin impact crater. Now, scientists had known about 5 years ago about one of the two impact craters, but only in 2013 were they able to realize, oh, wait, there's something more here. It's actually two impacts together. And then when you add them up together right next to each other, it makes the largest one in the world that they've discovered so far.
Wow.
Just on a technical point, Evan, they're calling it an impact zone, not an impact crater, because the crater eroded long ago, but you can see the impact zone based upon the geology.
How long ago did this happen?
Well, that's the big, big part of this mystery is they're not exactly sure when this happened. The estimates right now are coming in at anywhere between 300 million and 600 million years ago. It's kind of a wide, you know, target, but they're searching for more clues. It's a mystery.
And that's important because
extinction event?
Yeah, I mean, this is four times the size of the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs at the KT extinction event. Mm-hmm. And so you would think that it would correspond with a massive extinction, but it doesn't. So they think that they probably have the dates off.
Right. There's, when you have these impacts, there's debris that obviously gets kicked up and sort of can, well, on a scale this size will circle the planet. and leave a nice layer for scientists, you know, hundreds of millions of years later to discover it. But we don't have that with this particular impact, at least not yet. They have not been able to discern any sort of debris layer that would sort of tie it together to a specific age, at least, and say this layer is when this happened, and we know between this layer, this is the time, and peg it right where they want to. So it's a mystery, but very cool that they were able to, you know, figure out that something, you know, measuring 250 miles in diameter, and they're able to discern that, this was an enormous asteroid impact. Over 400 kilometers in diameter.
That's huge.
That's impressive. Oh, for note, the previous record holder was the Redfort crater in South Africa, measuring in at 236 miles in diameter, or 380 kilometers. That one impacted the Earth 2 billion years ago.
Yeah. There was just bacteria around at that time.
Yeah.
Is there any visible remnant of the impact thing, or has it been all sort of grown over and worn out over the last, whatever, 300 to 600 million years? I mean, is there...
No crater.
There's no crater
at
nothing.
All.
Okay.
Just the geological evidence, right? Like the impact
the crushing.
Glass.
Yeah.
Right. Satellite imagery won't reveal it
right.
as cleanly as it will other impacts.
Yeah.
It's like the one in Guatemala, the KT one, right? That's also like just, there's no real evidence of it, right?
The Yucatan
Peninsula. Yucatan.
Yeah.
But we're still early in this story. I mean, this is, you know, preliminary. Scientists need to figure out, they need to date it better. They need to look around the Earth for the dust layer. They need to, you know, verify the evidence for the impact, see if it corresponds with any extinction, et cetera. So, yeah, all the pieces to this puzzle are not yet in place.
Have you guys been to the one in Arizona?
No. I've seen it on TV, though.
I wish.
My parents went. My parents went about a couple of years ago, and they said it was incredible that you have no – there's no sense of scale.
Right?
You stand on the edge of this thing, and you look down into it, and you can't you know, you sort of realize that there's a – what you're seeing is a parking lot, but you think it's just like this, like a lid or something. You'd have no scale. It's so big and they're so flat and so whatever. So yeah, really cool.
Yeah. I remember when we went to the, Evan and I and our families went to the Grand Canyon and you stand on the, have you ever been there, George?
I was there, but it was actually, snowing. So I saw a big white wall of nothing.
I see.
Boy,
oh, that's
got to go back. So
I know
you stand on the edge of the Grand Canyon, and it is absolutely unbelievable. The thing that you realize is that when you see it on video, on TV, on pictures, you can't appreciate the real scale of it. You know, only seeing it in person can you really get a feel of how absolutely massive and gorgeous it is. So
yeah,
it's definitely an experience you got to have at some point.
It encompasses your entire peripheral view of everything. It just keeps going
amazing.
And going. You're turning your head 180 degrees and trying to take it all in, and that doesn't even do it. So
right.
It really is amazing.
All right, George, you're going to tell us why scientists are going to be mining human excrement for gold.
Cool. Yeah. You know, they say that Americans are full of shit, and apparently we really are. There's something like 7 million tons of biosolids are produced by Americans every year. And that's not just that's not just the poop, but it's sort of the condensed treated sewage. Mm-hmm. So the treated sewage sludge. And it turns out that for some reason within this human treated sludge, there's a significant amounts of gold, silver, platinum, copper, and vanadium, all very expensive, all very valuable.
What?
Metals.
You're shitting me.
I am not shitting you. And that will soon be taken as a compliment, that if you're shitting someone, you're actually giving them something of value. There's been this 8-year-long study done analyzing treatment plants and from all over the country, from a bunch of different places. And they were wondering, as they were finding these trace amounts of gold and all these valuable metals, was it located in a certain area? Was there some anomaly that was causing, you know, Western poop to be more full of gold than Eastern poop, or Northern or Southern? And it turns out that it's pretty much across the board. Whatever crap you grab and go through, It's got a significant amount of these elements. An 8-year study testing sewage samples found that on average for 1 kilogram of sludge, they found 0.4 milligrams of gold, 28 milligrams of silver, 638 milligrams of copper, and 49 milligrams of vanadium. Now, vanadium is used in cell phones. It's a very important metal for technological stuff, computers and cell phones.
It's a rare earth. It's a,
expensive, one of those rare earth
REM
metals. There's a sewage treatment plant already in Tokyo that has been using this process of extracting these precious metals, and their yield from human poop is rivaling what's found in raw ore at leading gold mines.
What?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
Oh, my God. Well, they said the quote I saw is that it reaches the level of a quote-unquote minimal mineral deposit, which I suspect is the amount that you have before it's worthwhile to actually mine it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's above the line where it's actually cost effective to mine it. You'll get more money back in the precious metals that you extract.
Right. Mine.
It's like you can get gold out of seawater, but it's not worth it. You have to spend more money to do it. But this is way in the other direction. Another cool thing is that normally when in some of the gold mining, they use these chemicals, these leachates, which, you know, pull the precious metals out of rock and out of sediment and things like that. Those chemicals are pretty nasty to the surrounding ecosystem.
Harsh.
Very harsh, yeah. So what's nice is you can use those same chemicals, but because it's in a sewage treatment plant, it's much more controlled. And they're already set up to process chemicals that are hazardous and dangerous. So you can spray this stuff, you can use these leachates, and you can pretty effectively grab these precious metals. And it's incredible. The really incredible thing is no one has figured out exactly why this is happening. No one knows where this gold is coming from.
How gold gets into our – well, it's coming from us.
Right, yeah. But there's I guess there's detergents. There's some clothing. They're wondering somehow this is being ingested by people, and it's coming out. But where precisely it's coming from, they haven't quite figured out yet, which to me I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
My guess is it would be in the things we consume, fruits, vegetables, other foods. Meats,
I was thinking that as well, but since our excrement is, has a significant proportion of like dead bacteria, maybe the bacteria somehow are producing this. But then again, the bacteria would get it from the food, I guess. But I would
well, they're,
look at the
they're
bacteria
thinking it's,
first.
Well, food plants will take up minerals from the ground, including gold.
Right.
Remember the story about the eucalyptus trees in Australia that are sucking up gold from the ground? Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Well, they're saying hair products, cosmetics. Those things have some metals in them too, you know, detergents as well. You have these sort of rare, I guess, metals or small amounts to let them do the thing that they do in terms of bonding with dirt molecules and all that kind of stuff. So that might be a part of it as well. But it's really interesting. It's really interesting.
Yeah,
in fact,
I
just love that they don't know where it's coming from.
I mean, did you ever hear that saying that like he thinks he shits gold? Well, it's actually true.
It's actually true.
Yeah.
You know, I guess you could say that we all have the Midas touch to us.
Yes, the Midas colon.
Some part of us do. Just a quick announcement before we go on to other things. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is announcing a public hearing on their regulation of homeopathic products.
Wow.
And they're looking for input from the public. This will be April 20th and 21st, so just next month, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Silver Spring, Maryland. We'll have the link for all the information. So, hey, if you could be in Silver Spring, Maryland on April 20th to 21st, and you wouldn't mind getting up in front of the FDA and explaining to them that homeopathic remedies are pure pseudoscientific bullshit, then you can go online and you can register to get you to have your 15 minutes to give them this feedback. You can be sure that the homeopaths are going to be there telling them how wonderful it is. So we need to pack that room with as many skeptics as possible. Unfortunately, I have like work and stuff, so like I can't be there. But so the other science-based medicine guys and I will be investigating this, seeing exactly what kind of information they're looking for, and But they do say they do have specific questions, but they're also just interested in open-ended feedback from the public. So it certainly couldn't hurt to get some skeptics in that room armed with some information about homeopathic.
Overdose. Overdose.
Yeah, right. Just
seriously.
The overdose.
Yeah.
Explain how if one molecule of the substance were a grain of rice, it would have to be, they're dissolved in a sphere of water the size of the solar system with Pluto at the outer end of the solar system. That's how much water, that's how diluted these solutions are.
As one of my colleagues pointed out, they must already know that it's pseudoscientific nonsense. So.
Yes. Yeah, some of them.
What are they really doing
not
here?
Not necessarily, though. You know the depths that people can go.
We also don't know how much leeway they have because Congress controls what FDA can
right.
do.
But who knows who's on the board, too? Who knows who's in positions of power, how they got there?
Who got appointed, right?
You know, you would think that the people on the science committee in Congress, understood things about science, but that's not
that's right. Think. Like the Earth is 6,000 years
right.
old.
It's a huge assumption.
But anyway, we'll be that voice in the wilderness and get the skeptical position.
Yeah.
Position heard.
Get your activism on. Yeah.
Well, guys, let's move on to a question this week. Actually, I got about 30 or 40 emails. I asked you guys to tell me about your experience with composting. And a lot of you emailed in to tell me your experience. George, do you compost?
No, but I recycle a lot of my jokes.
Oh, good.
That's a good form of composting.
The emails were very nice. Most of them were extremely polite and informative. A couple were unnecessarily snarky, but that's par
Thank
for the
you
course.
For those.
You mean they were smelly? They were kind of stinky? They were kind of gross and moist and covered in a – yeah.
When you deal with any kind of environmental issue like this, some people, right. I think emotions run high with some people. But anyway, the gist of my, I was answering a question about composting versus using a disposal. And the gist of the treatment of it was that composting is a great idea, but it's a lot of work. But I haven't done it. So I asked people who've done it to write in and tell me their experience. The overwhelming consensus of people who wrote in is that it's not that much work, that it's composting is easy.
I liked one guy said that. Comparing the time spent to a pet was maybe not accurate, unless your pet was like a goldfish.
Yeah. All right, but here's the thing.
I didn't say what kind of pet.
Which are compostable, by the way.
So, but some of the emailers were, I think, put it into perspective by saying that you can lazy compost really easy.
Don't even turn it.
Again, I admit I haven't composted before, although I'm definitely going to compost this summer just so I can do it for myself and see how it goes.
Plus, Steve, do the dishes. Honey, I'm lazy composting.
So I read a lot about composting, and they certainly make it seem difficult or at least labor intensive.
That's high-end composting.
Well, the thing is, I did think that you had to do at least some of this stuff to get it to work. And what people are saying is, no, you just could throw your organic waste, basically any vegetable matter, into the bin and forget about it. That's it. You don't have to do anything else. But if you read, like, how to compost or composting 101 sites, this is the kind of things they tell you to do. So I'm going to quickly go over, like, how to do high-end composting. One thing is that you have to mix brown compost and green compost in the right ratio. 3-1. 3-1 brown to green is optimal.
You lost me already.
Brown are things that are high in carbon, like leaves. So leaves are brown, right? That's how you know about that. Or you can use shredded paper, or you can use cardboard or things like that. Then, and green things are like grass, weeds, and then basically all the vegetable matter from your kitchen, right? I forgot to mention, do not throw meat in your compost pile because that will attract maggots. Although some people said you could do that, but you have to know exactly what you're doing. So best off just not putting any meat in your compost pile. You could put eggshells. Eggshells are fine. Coffee grounds, tea bags, those are all good. So those are high in nitrogen. And you have to balance the carbon and nitrogen so that you can feed and not kill your organisms. A lot of sites and the instructions that I had on how to do it said you might want to, there are various ways that you can use get the bacteria in there, products that you could buy to sort of start the culture going. But most people said, the bacteria's in the soil. You don't have to worry about it. The bacteria will get in there. And the worms are doing most of the decomposing anyway. So just as long as it's connected to the ground, right? You don't want to, if you have the bin should be open on the bottom so it's touching the ground. Although some sites say you might want to put it on like a wood platform or on sticks so that you can aerate underneath better. You do have to turn it to aerate it, but again, some of our emails said they don't do it at all. Sites say you should do it once or twice a week, or you could do it less often. The bottom line is the more frequently you turn the compost, the more evenly it'll be mixed together and the faster the whole process will go. So this doesn't, it's not necessary, but it makes it go faster. One site I read said that you can actually measure the temperature of your compost heap to get it up to like that 140 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit level.
Whoa.
Which is like whatever that is in Celsius. And that if you get, you want to, because the temperature tells you how quickly it's decomposing. And if it gets hot enough, it'll kill off any weed seeds and it'll kill off any pathogens. So you want to maintain the temperature by turning it and tweaking the ratio of the carbon rich and nitrogen rich and keeping the moisture content just right. If it gets too wet, it'll get smelly. If it gets too dry, it won't decompose. If you get it too hot, you'll kill off your worms. You can worm decompose, you can worm compost like with red worms, but then you want to keep it cool. You don't want to make it get hot because that will kill off the worms. So forgive me for thinking that this is a little complicated.
Where does the styrofoam go?
Yeah, right. So, so the bottom line is, I guess, is that you can make it as easy or as hard as you want to. I guess it's like saying, yeah, gardening is easy. You just throw plants in the ground. The shit grows. It rains and you can pick it when it's ready. Yeah, you could garden that way. You could also high-end garden where you're are carefully choosing which plants you plant next to others and the soil pH and the amount of moisture and the exact ratio of fertilizer for the different kinds of plants and knowing how to rotate and harvest and all that stuff. So you could high-end garden as well. Composting is the same. You could, one guy said, I just throw stuff in a hole in the ground and it turns into dirt and then I plant shit on it. That was his composting.
Okay.
The problem with that though is that it attracts critters. If you have an open compost pile and little critters attract bigger critters. So I think there's probably a happy medium in there, you know, where you're paying some attention to what you're putting in there and maybe turning it occasionally, and but you're not driving yourself crazy with it. So I'm going to give it a try. I'll see if I can successfully compost. And it does turn into a nice, rich soil that you could then use in your garden. So at the end, and you do keep it out of the landfill, which is the ultimate goal, right?
Right.
Hey, George.
Yeah.
You know what happened when they buried Mozart?
He decomposed.
You're such a good rogue. You know exactly. I set him up. You knock him down.
That was great.
All right. This brings us to the dumbest thing I heard this week. Actually, we had a lot of
that was it right there. Nicely done.
A lot of contenders this week, but I went with Ted Cruz. Mainly because he just announced that he's running for president. So, you know.
Oh
that,
my God. If only 2% of the things I've read about him on Facebook are true. Oh my God.
So, Republican from Texas who doesn't believe in global warming said, and I quote, "You know, it used to be it is accepted scientific wisdom the earth is flat. And this heretic named Galileo was branded a denier," he said.
Yep.
So,
oh God.
If you're going to make a comment like that, don't be historically inaccurate.
A poor sea moron.
Yeah. So, first of all, Galileo didn't demonstrate that the Earth wasn't flat. He demonstrated, or he promoted the idea put forward by Copernicus that the Earth goes around the sun rather than the other way around. Nothing to do with the Earth being flat. And it was never, ever, ever accepted scientific wisdom that the Earth was flat. The ancient Greeks figured out that the Earth was a sphere, was basically round. And that has been the accepted scientific wisdom ever since. It is a myth. It is a myth that medieval scholars thought the Earth was flat. It's not true. So every time someone says, oh, they used to think the Earth was flat, they're doubly wrong. It's not true, and it's a stupid point anyway, that because they were wrong in the past, that you know they're wrong now. So, and Cruz is making what we call the Galileo gambit, comparing himself to Galileo. Really. It's like, yeah,
don't do that.
They made fun of Galileo and he turned out to be right. So therefore, every crank to, you know, spouting nonsense today is also right, I guess.
Wasn't that great where he announced his candidacy?
Yeah, right.
Did you see where that was?
At Liberty University.
Liberty University.
Old stomping grounds. Yeah.
In Lynchburg, Virginia.
Lynchburg. Of all places.
and the students were required to be there. Yeah. 10,000 students were required to be there, or else they were fined $10.
Yep.
Really?
I would have gladly paid that.
And 50 rosaries. Yeah.
That's exactly who you want, you know, when you're starting your campaign to be president of these United States.
Next.
You want to
Next.
Be in front of a crowd that's forced to be there in a religiously based institution. Love it.
Mm-hmm. And that's why he's polling at like 2%.
Well, we have a wonderful interview coming up with a gentleman who wants to go to Mars. Let's hear what he has to say about himself. Joining us now is Chris Patil. Chris, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
So, Chris, you are joining us because apparently you are a finalist for the Mars One project. So tell us about that.
All right. Well, the Mars One project is nominally a privately funded one-way trip to colonize the planet Mars by the year 2027. About 2 years ago, the organization solicited applications from around the world, and some number of thousands of people applied, filling out an application, something a lot like a college application, but with stranger questions. That group was narrowed down to about 1,000 at the beginning of 2014. And then at the beginning of 2015, it was narrowed down to 100. And those of us that are still in contention will at some point be narrowed down to 40 and then 24, split into six groups of four people who will train as astronauts for the next 9 to 11 years. And then hopefully we will go to Mars to live out the rest of our lives, prepare the planet for future human habitation, and do a lot of interesting science.
What qualifies you for this mission, Chris?
Well, I think that a couple of things make me a good candidate for somebody who could undergo training to become qualified. I don't think anyone is currently qualified to be a Mars colonist, but I think that they have different levels of talents that could make them good candidates for training. In my case, I think I bring a couple of things to the table. One is I have a PhD in biochemistry, so I know how to do experiments, how to interpret data, and how to operate in an environment where nobody knows the answer, and you have to figure out the answers for yourself. And I think that's true of anyone who's trained as a scientist, but I certainly am. Second of all, in addition to my biological training, I'm also, in my opinion, a very good scientific generalist. I'm somebody who understands a lot of different things about a lot of different fields and is able to synthesize them and bring them together. I think that kind of interdisciplinary perspective is very valuable in an effort like Mars One, in which the astronauts will have to know a lot about astronomy, physics, chemistry, biology,
surgery,
environmental engineering. You know, I think that generalism is something that I bring to the table. And also, I think I'm a good communicator.
And you apparently don't have any friends on Earth?
That's something that comes up a lot. You know, the idea that those of us who would sign up for a one-way trip to Mars must somehow be rejecting either of the human species as a whole or social life as a whole. But really, nothing could be further from the truth. I've gotten to know about 75 of the other candidates reasonably well over the course of the last month. And these are people with thriving and robust social lives here on Earth. These are people who love the human species and love individual humans a great deal. They accept that there are sacrifices that need to be made in order to colonize Mars, and they're willing to make those sacrifices.
Are you married?
I'm not.
There's obviously been a lot of controversies around the Mars One mission. One of those controversies is whether or not we actually have the technology to get people to Mars alive. I'm sure you're familiar with the MIT report.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us does that make you a little worried that some nerds at MIT think that you'll die before you get to Mars?
I don't actually think that's what the paper said.
Yeah.
So one of the things the paper said, the way that the MIT white paper, which by the way wasn't a peer-reviewed publication, it was, it was a report. One of the things that it proposed is that if you do life support a certain way, according to their software simulations, the oxygen tension in the environment would be exhausted or after 68 days. But that was the first of several simulations that were couched in terms of, if we make this assumption, the following thing will happen. But there were many simulations they performed subsequent to that one that show that there were solutions to the oxygen problem. And that's right there in the paper for anyone to read.
Yeah.
So basically, the 68-day issue, which is one of the most oft-repeated controversial features of the mission, is essentially an object lesson in, let's not do it that way. Let's do it correctly. Let's perhaps separate the module where the oxygen is being produced by the growing plants from the place where the astronauts live. Let's create certain kinds of venting and separation environments that will prevent either too high of an oxygen level from accumulating, or will prevent a loss of pressure if that oxygen has to be vented to the outside. So there were certainly scenarios in which the MIT study points out we could run into some trouble, and I interpret those as simply saying, let's not do it that way, let's do it another way.
Yeah, it didn't seem like a deal breaker. It just was like a one technical thing that you have to consider.
Right. I mean, there's obviously a huge number of technical considerations here, and I think this is a very hard problem, and I think that one of the things that I think is very important to emphasize is that, you know, 11 years before we nominally would go to Mars, all of the pieces are not in place, okay? Which was also true of the Apollo program, which is true of almost every major space mission. And, you know, Mars One has said that we can do this using existing technology. Now, I actually part company with the organization on that. I don't think it's possible for us to do this with existing technology, but I think it's possible for us to do it with existing technology and novel combinations and some new technologies that are created and developed over the course of the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think just incremental technology. I don't think we don't need a massive breakthrough in anything. Just need to make things good enough to complete the mission.
And it's important not to, you know, let's not oversimplify. Novel combinations of existing technologies can have their own surprising corollaries. You know, it's by no means obvious how to make all of these complicated systems work together, but, you know, happily we have 10 years to do that. And the timeline of Mars One involves testing certainly the landing systems exhaustively before ever putting a human into them, and having life support systems on Mars running for years before human beings are ever put in the position where they're depending on those things for their lives. So I think that it's true that today we don't have all the pieces in place. I think it's true that in 10 years we very well might. And that assumes a lot of things. It assumes that finances get together in a way that we can do the technology development, sign the deals with, you know, organizations like Lockheed that might help us build a communication satellite, other organizations that might help us with life support. And that involves motivating both investors and the public at large to be excited enough about this to direct resources toward Mars One so that those monies can be spent appropriately.
Hey, Chris, one technical issue, one piece of the puzzle that would concern me greatly that I'm not sure could necessarily be solved in 10 years is the whole problem with cosmic ray exposure and getting the proper shielding. I mean, we do have a solution to that. You just have to launch, you know, enough shielding, whether that's in metal or water or whatever, but that would just make it prohibitively expensive. Are they seriously looking at that issue?
They are. There was a paper published in Science. I can't quote chapter and verse on it. I can find it for you. That was published a couple of years ago that projected the radiation exposure en route, assuming a 7 to 8 month, home and transfer trajectory from Earth to Mars. And it made a lot of assumptions about the kind of shielding that would be available in the interplanetary craft. Obviously, the human exposure is a function of the environment, that is to say, deep space, minus the effect of whatever shielding you have. So you have to kind of model in that shielding. So this would be a combination of the walls of the craft, the water which is stored in the walls of the craft, etc. And it turned out that the total exposure for the trip was well under the lifetime exposure for ESA or NASA astronauts. Then, once you get to the surface of Mars, obviously you're in an environment where you're on a planet that doesn't have an ozone layer, where the radiation dose rate is much higher than it is here on Earth. But the idea is to create habitats and then cover them with Martian soil to the tune of about 5 meters deep, which would provide the same protection to people living in those environments that Earth's atmosphere provides us. And, you know, the projections that I've read, according to Mars One, are that over the course of a reasonably long life on Mars, one could still get in under the lifetime maximum exposure for NASA and ESA astronauts and still be allowed to do things like get outside, to go on EVA and do interesting science out there, you know, on the surface of Mars.
Yeah, but do you think you'd have to have those habitats built before you get there?
The idea is for them to be built before we get there, exactly. So the way the landers are timed, the first lander in the first launch window that was going to be 2018 and now it looks like it'll be in 2020 will simply be a test of the lander itself. And then it will be followed by a series of landers. The lander modules will themselves contain the equipment to perform certain functions. There will be landers that contain life support systems, landers that contain habitation modules, and by that I mean they'll be connected to large inflatable devices that will actually provide the living modules themselves, but the landers will house that inflatable material when they land. And there'll also be lander modules that contain atmosphere processing and water and air storage facilities. And the other idea is to land a couple of rovers, which will, again, notionally, and I think this will be a neat trick if we can get it to pull off, the rovers will pull the landers from where they land to the site of the base, line them up, connect them, and get the life support systems running. And then, you know, the HAB modules will be in place. And I'm not sure whether the idea is that the rovers themselves will do the digging and covering of the inflatable habitats with soil. I suspect that's going to require human intervention just because I don't think we have robots currently that can do that even on Earth. That just sounds like a really complicated undertaking. But, you know, what do I know? Maybe in 10 years we'll be able to do that robotically. But I think the idea is that at first we won't have that shielding, but that will be the first order of business, essentially, is to get the HABs under the dirt.
Chris, about you mentioned robot technology being kind of a key part of all this during the course of this, and robot technology is going to, well, we believe, become more sophisticated as we get closer to the potential launch of this. With that said, can you make an argument as to why we wouldn't just wait until we have the more sophisticated robots that we have that can do the job that almost that humans could do and just send tons of robots to Mars to sort of do the same work and no life would have to be risked?
Well, I think that's a great idea, unless what you want to do is create a human habitation on Mars, in which case there's no substitute for sending actual humans. I think that the idea that I found provocative, and maybe the question that you're not asking, but I'm going to go ahead and answer it anyway, is why not just wait until we have really autonomous robots that can go and set up a really awesome habitation for humans, requiring us to basically do no more than land, walk in the door of a fully functional facility, without having to spend a lot of time with uncovered habitations. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's always a reason to delay a mission according to the principle, this will be easier to do in the future. Okay, but by that logic, one might never go.
Chris, George here. I'm just along those lines. To you, if you get selected to be one of the finalists or the person that goes, what to you is the best case scenario, absolute best case way this plays out in the next 10, 15 years? What to you would be the ultimate sort of best way for it to play out?
One of the best case scenarios is a scientific scenario where we go to Mars and in relatively short order acquire unambiguous evidence that Mars at one point hosted life. All right, so that's one of the huge payoffs of a mission like this. I would love for that to happen. Obviously, I don't know that that can happen because I don't know whether Mars was ever alive, but that would be awesome. If that were, it would be an answer to one of the most fundamental and important scientific questions ever posed, which is, are we alone in the universe? So that would be scientifically a best case scenario for me. Speaking more broadly about human presence on Mars, the best thing that Mars One can do, a successful Mars One mission, is illustrate that it can be done. I anticipate that the moment any organization shows that humans can successfully make it to Mars and live productive lives there, there will be a lot of copycats. There will be a lot of people who want to get on that train. And if Mars One gets there in 2027, everyone is okay, and the astronauts set about living productive and happy lives, I think that it will inspire a large migration of humans to Mars. I think that would be amazing. So, you know, inspiration would be one of the biggest and best case scenarios of a successful Mars One mission.
Before we get to, you know, other discussions about how cool this would be, let's deal with some of the skepticism about the Mars One and the company and the mission. So there have been a number of writers who have written what are essentially presented as exposés about the company, saying that they're just basically not up to the task. For example, Australian writer Elmo Keep wrote, "Mars One doesn't appear to be in any way qualified to carry off the biggest, most complex, most audacious, and most dangerous exploration mission in all of human history." And Keep goes through a number of very specific deficiencies, such as the company simply doesn't have the connections and contracts with the companies that it needs to, that it's saying that it has in order to pull this off. So are you familiar with that criticism? And what
absolutely.
Do you think about
I've read Ms. Keep's articles at length and in depth. And I think that she's one of the harshest critics of the Mars One project. I mean, it's worth mentioning that Ms. Keep is a skeptic about the value of space exploration in general, and so definitely has a personal agenda. That said, she's not all wrong about some of these things. One of the arguments it's made is that Mars One as an organization is too small to pull off the colonization of Mars. And I think that that's absolutely true. I think that if Mars One never hires anyone, they are not going to get this off the ground. That they absolutely need to scale up. They need to have a much larger in-house engineering team. They need to have a much larger training force that's going, you know, the people that are involved in training the astronauts. You know, this is essentially a tiny startup at this point. And one of the very legitimate grounds for skepticism is they just don't have the manpower to mount an effort like this. And I think that the important word to add to that sentence is yet. They don't have the people yet. They'd better get the people. I would, as a candidate, be really excited to see that process moving on more rapidly. But that's not to say it can't happen or that it won't happen. So, you know, if progress isn't made in that direction, I'll be more and more skeptical with time, but I don't think it's too late. I think this can happen in the future.
What's been the most surprising thing of this whole process for you, Chris? Or unexpected?
You know, one of the most surprising things has also been one of the greatest things about it. And it's been the response of young people to the idea of Mars colonization. I've done a lot of talking with school groups and student groups of various kinds, and I find that young people are so excited about the prospect of human exploration of Mars. And I feel very strongly that one of the great values of Mars One is to engage in a serious conversation about how we might someday colonize the solar system. Because whether or not Mars One does it, this generation of people will colonize the solar system. And I think that young people today who see people engaging in a serious conversation about that process are going to be excited and inspired to pursue careers in science and engineering so that they themselves might participate in that process when they're adults. And it's just an amazing feeling to go in front of a group of kids and talk about the technical issues involved and the scientific challenges and value of a mission like this and just see their eyes light up and see how excited they are. And it takes me back to my own youth and my own inspiration to become a scientist watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos on the floor of my family room. I'm old enough to have done that when it was first broadcast. I just think it's been really great. And I wasn't anticipating getting so much out of talking to young people about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that probably at the end of the day, the probability that this specific project, Mars One, actually lands people on Mars is pretty low, just because it's a massively complicated and expensive endeavor. And I suspect that the first attempt to do it is not going to succeed, but it may. There's no particular reason why it absolutely can't. But I think even if it doesn't succeed directly, it will inform the overall process of getting to Mars. I think it's, at the very least, will be an exciting thought experiment. And I agree that the best thing that could come out of this, whether or not it succeeds, is just exciting a generation of people about space travel and science and engineering and technology. This, you know, could have the same kind of effect that, you know, Sputnik and Apollo did a generation earlier. I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, I
could not agree more. I couldn't have said it better myself.
So I do hope, I hope we get to see you on Mars one day. That would be awesome. Listen, Chris, you know, if you make it through the selection process, we'll be happy to get you back on the show and track your progress through the program and the progress of Mars One itself. Obviously, we're skeptics. We're going to be looking at this with a skeptical eye, but at the same time, a very, I think, hopeful and excited eye, because we're also geeks and nerds and love all this kind of shit. So let's see what happens. You know, what's the worst thing that could happen is it fails, right? And then so what?
Indeed.
Yeah.
And I think the worst thing that could happen is that we never try.
Yeah. So. Or maybe the worst thing that happens is that you all die horribly en route to Mars.
But good TV. Good TV.
It would be good TV.
And with that.
High ratings.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, my goodness. It's been such a pleasure talking to you guys.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chris. Chris Patil.
Okay.
In the top 100 for the Mars One. You got two more cuts ahead of you. When are those cuts going to be made?
They'll happen sometime this fall or early next year, and they'll happen in pretty rapid succession. There'll be a training exercise that lasts some length of time. Then that will be one cut. And then there will be an isolation exercise where the team is placed under duress in an isolated environment for some length of time, and that will get us down to the final 24.
Yeah.
That's supposed to happen within the next 9 to 12 months.
All right, Chris, good talking with you.
Great talking to you guys.
Good luck.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
And George.
George, this week, I have a theme that I picked out especially for you.
I have a theme.
The theme is music.
What? What's that now? Moo what?
Music.
I thought you said you're sick.
Okay, just for you, George.
Wow.
Great.
Are you ready?
The pressure,
not fair.
No, oh my gosh. All
bass clef is not a real clef.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. A 2014 systematic review finds that listening to Mozart, particularly Sonata for Two Pianos in D Major, or K-448, significantly reduced seizure frequency and epileptiform discharges on electroencephalogram in seizure patients. Item number two, Elvis Presley, a prolific songwriter, penned more top 40 hits than any other artist. And item number three, a 2012 study found that modern pop music has evolved over the last 50 years to an increasingly simplified palette of pitch transitions and timbre. In fact, a great deal of modern pop music is based off the same four chord progressions.
All right. Am I first?
Yes, George. I'll have you go first.
Why?
Because he asked.
I don't have to go first.
Because he opened up his mouth.
The seizure Mozart one, I think that is real. I would think that is real. I bet it's not specifically just for Mozart. If you were to use other types of music, that would probably have a similar effect. But I bet that study used that music and had that effect. Elvis penning the most top 40? I am extremely doubtful that that is true because from my understanding, and I'm not totally sure about this, but Elvis was more interpreter than composer. And the pitch and timbre of most pop music being similar, I think that is pretty true, with the four chord idea being, if you consider that the 1, 4, and 5 chord are three of those four chords, I would bet that that's really, really true. So I would say that Elvis penning the top 40 hits would be fiction.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, the Mozart one, I can kind of see that happening. Something about how the music is laid out, having an impact. It's not really raising a red flag, at least not as much as some of these other ones. The pop music and the four chords, I don't know if that's a myth that's been passed around. It could be total bullshit. But I'm gonna agree with George, not because he's the music expert here, but that was kind of my inclination. I've kind of got the feeling, and that's all it is, that he didn't really, you know, necessarily write a lot of his own stuff anyway. I really am not sure, but that kind of strikes me as very possible. And I really think he may have been eclipsed in terms of the number of top 40 hits by other artists. So I'll say Elvis is fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
I hate to be the third one to go along with the group. I'm going to go there though and say that the Elvis one is the fiction. But about Mozart, specifically, so I would guess that that song somehow hits the certain right notes that counteract or act as a anti-frequency to the seizure frequency or something like that. They sort of negate each other out. Perhaps, something's going on there, I believe. And then the evolution of pop music, I've always thought of, I think rock and roll is three chords, is it not? So that rock and roll is so much in itself has evolved. Is it more than that? Yeah, so the evolution of music, certainly, I think it's totally reasonable that a four chord progression has sort of transpired off of that since the last 50 years. So I think that's entirely believable. It leaves the Elvis Presley one as the only one to be fiction.
Okay, so I guess we could take this in order.
I think we're in for a surprise.
Probably.
Otherwise, he never would have let George go first. So I should have.
George! George, is this going to be the week that you're going to turn around your record in science fiction?
No, it's not.
Okay. Let's find out. Number one, a 2014 systematic review finds that listening to Mozart, particularly Sonata for Two Pianos in D Major, or K448, significantly reduced seizure frequency and epileptiform discharges on electroencephalogram in seizure patients. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay, Mozart.
Yeah, the thing about this game is you're always right at least once.
at least once. Yeah. Very interesting.
50-50.
Do you have it? Do you have it?
I'm not going to say that this is settled science. It is still controversial, but a 2014 systematic review that found 12 studies looking at this phenomenon and concluded that, taken together, yeah, there's a pretty significant effect there. Not all the studies compared it to other music. We definitely need to do larger placebo-controlled trials or other music-controlled trials to really confirm the effect, but so far it seems to be there. It's completely plausible. There are people who actually can have seizures provoked by listening to specific pieces of music. Did you know
right.
that?
Right.
Yeah. This is the opposite. There are other situations in which some kind of stimulation can, you know, it causes a synchronous firing in your brain, which can sort of crowd out the seizure signals and keep them from spreading, you know. Or in this case, even keep the seizure discharges from occurring in the first place. So very interesting. And why Mozart K448? I don't know.
I doubt it's specific to the piece. I would assume it's the polyphony that's happening, the multiple musical lines.
Yeah.
That your brain is sort of, it's almost acting like a comb, I would think. Mm-hmm. In terms of like untangling that, because you can hear these independent lines happening so brilliantly, the way he would write this stuff. I bet that the polyphony of it is what's really doing it. I mean, if I had to guess.
Or maybe the progression. You know, he wrote very mathematically and had intuition about the
But
you
know, I bet
sequences.
If you played Bach, or if you played Telemann, or if you played any contemporaries of Mozart on some level, you'd probably get similar results, I would think. Or even modern composers that use that same sort of style of multiple lines, deep sort of mathematic polyphony. I bet that would work.
Yeah, it's interesting, and if the effect really does hold up with really large studies, it would be interesting to see what kinds of music work. Is it right? Will you get this from any music to the same degree? Is it just the fact that you're listening to music is stimulating your brain and drowning out the seizures, right. or is there something about the music itself, the mathematical progression, or as you say, the polyphony,
or the timbre of it too? Yeah, you know, there might be something just inherent in classical instruments.
Does it have to resonate with some part of your brain to have that effect? Yeah, that's interesting. So that question has not been answered by research so far. All right, let's move on to number two. Elvis Presley, a prolific songwriter, penned more top 40 hits than any other artist. You guys all think this is fiction. You're all dissing Elvis, the king. Guys, he was the king.
Elvis Ooh. Aaron Presley. Yeah, thank you very much.
But this one is absolutely fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Yes.
Good job, guys.
I don't like rock music. I like looking at little girls. That's about it.
How many songs do you think Elvis Presley wrote?
Very few.
Wrote?
Yeah, very few. Yeah, probably not too many.
Zero.
Did he have a co-writing?
He may have wrote songs, they just never made it to recordings.
No, he said he never wrote a song in his life.
There you go.
He was drunk when he said that.
He got
that would have been a better fiction, Steve. That I would have guessed that wasn't true. That Elvis wrote zero tunes. I would have said he had co-written at least one. But no, wow.
Yeah, maybe. Awesome. But the other two were so cool, true ones that I wanted to use them.
Yeah.
He did get co-writing credit on a lot of his own songs.
That's a publishing trick, basically.
It's a publishing. So powerful artists and recording studios or whatever, if they, you know, use the songs written by some poor starving songwriter, they would strong arm them into giving co-writing credit to the star, you know.
That's why Dick Clark shows up on a lot of early 50s hits as co-writer.
Yeah. Because you also then you get the royalties too.
You get the royalties. That's where the money is. The money's in the royalties.
Yeah, exactly. It was a total scam. Yeah, but he said in an interview he never wrote a song. He said he had a couple of inspirations for some of his songs, but he didn't actually write them. Like he said, he woke up one morning all shook up. That's a song. I'm all shook up. Yeah, that was the extent of his artistic and
contribution to the
actual writing.
He heard something out back. What was that, Elvis? Oh, nothing but a hound dog.
Now, George, I also read in my research for this piece that none of the Beatles can write or read music. Did you ever hear that?
No.
Well, I mean,
maybe not when they started.
You need to define write because I mean, you write music as soon as whether you are notating it. That's a different issue. So they're obviously writing music. Yeah, they can't read. George Harrison, by the end of his life, could.
Yeah.
He was the one that sort of studied it because he just kind of got into it. But yeah, I know there's a very minimal amount of notational, understanding that Paul McCartney has or that Ringo, has. So, I mean, that's kind of the way it was done. And that's still pretty true in a lot of popular musicians. It's changed over the years. But,
when they're writing a song, they're just doing it without writing it down.
They might write down chord names. So if they're writing, like, you know, they'll have a lyric sheet and maybe they'll put, you know, over a certain word, they'll put a G, which means G chord or a G7 or a A minor. So they might write down that. I'm sure when they were doing it originally, because you couldn't sort of record stuff easily, they would write things down or just play it and play it and play it and play it and kind of get it in your head. Nowadays, you know, I don't write things down when I'm writing music because it's a very labor-intensive process. So I have very basic notes written to myself, and not in terms of notes like music notes, but just G minor 7, A minor, D. Maybe if there's a specific rhythm, I might write it out to remember it. But for the most part, I'm recording, and that's just the easier way to remember it. So most guys don't sit down with a pencil and lined staff paper and write. That happens. But most guys that are writing will just improvise and write.
Mozart apparently would, though. He would write, like, the final tweaked version of a symphony.
Well, that's a myth too. That's one of those. Yeah, that's one of those genius myths.
That's from
Amadeus.
A movie myth.
Yeah, there's actually they have copies of corrected pieces of his that he would make corrections. So the idea that it pours from God into his hand onto the paper, you know, not to take anything away, but I mean, like, there's the comparison of Mozart and Beethoven. You know, Beethoven would scratch stuff out and you would find all these, like, rewritten things and then corrections and margins and, like, the madness of him versus the purity and the precision and the divinely inspired Mozartian excellence. And that's kind of BS too.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's plenty of examples of corrections and stuff. So yeah, it's a great story.
Did he at least sleep with Salieri's girlfriend?
Oh, I can only hope.
Yeah.
Actually, it's another one. Salieri
was a different era, wasn't he?
No, so they were contemporaries, but Salieri actually was very helpful, and he was a very nice guy. That's a great film, and Amadeus is one of my favorite films.
Mine too.
Yeah. Fantastic.
But it's complete fabrication. Yeah. Complete fabrication.
I'm shocked.
Shocked, yes, I know.
A little liberty. What do you want?
Right.
All right, let's go on to number three. A 2012 study found that modern pop music has evolved over the last 50 years to an increasingly simplified palette of pitch transitions and timbre. In fact, a great deal of modern pop music is based off the same four chord progressions. Is science.
Yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different people doing this sort of science where they're looking at the patterns in the chords in modern music and especially pop music. But there was a specific study published a couple of years ago, Joan Serra, measuring the evolution of contemporary Western popular music. And she found that from 1950 to 2010, when she did her analysis. This is on a massive database. Are you familiar with this database, George?
The
million song database where they've actually entered in, like, the technical details of a lot of different songs.
Oh, unless that's like what Pandora uses in terms of the stylistic stuff.
Oh, I don't know.
That might be the same thing. Yeah.
So it includes, like, the year and the audio descriptions and whatever. So she was able to use this database to look for patterns over the years. She found that over the years, the pop music has gotten simpler and simpler with a reduced, like what she calls it, a homogenization of the timbre palette and fewer and fewer chord transitions and things like that. There's another guy, Dave Carlton. I don't know if you're familiar with this guy. He wrote a series of articles as well looking at, and he analyzed chords of 1,300 popular songs and also again found like the most common patterns that were used. And he did also find that one of the most popular chord progressions in popular music is the 1-5-6-4 progression. And you guys familiar with the Axis of Awesome?
Yeah.
You've seen that, George?
Yeah, great video, yeah.
Yeah, it's an awesome video. So 33 million hits on this video. The four chord song, where they basically play those four chords and then they sing like 100 different songs to those four that use those same four chords. And you realize how similar. Now, of course, a lot of people are quick to point out that there's a lot of artistry that could still occur within the framework of the chord, that one chord progression. So it doesn't mean all the songs are the same.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are very good songs. But it is interesting that so many of them settle upon that same chord progression. Now, George, is that deliberate? Are they saying, oh, I'm going to use the four chord progression because that's what popular songs use? Or do you think it's more just, it's in our blood? You know, we're so familiar with that.
Well, I mean, harmonically, what's happening in a lot of music is that certain kinds of selections, chordal selections and melodic selections lead to other chordal and melodic selections. So things tend to want to go to a certain place. So when you're writing certain kinds of melodies, they tend to want to resolve in a certain direction. That's what music theory is, this idea of saying that, you know, if you have a five chord, the fifth chord, you know, based on the fifth note of a scale, you want to go back to one. I mean, it could be argued that all of Western music is basically two chords. It's basically a one chord and a five chord. All of Western music, you can argue that that is basically how all of Western music works. It's just the filigree. It's just the extensions of that five and that one. That's a very basic thing, but I don't think it's a conscious idea of, oh, let's tap into this known chord progression. Because for the most part, people that are writing those songs aren't musically trained or necessarily harmonically savvy for the most part.
Yeah.
People that are writing pop songs, you know, you don't have the Brill building kind of thing of those guys writing pop tunes necessarily. So it's a lot of people that are finding these chords themselves.
And how much of it, I wonder, is innate and how much is cultural? Like, is it, cause you like songs that you've heard before because they all immediately resonate with you and you feel a certain way when you listen to them. And so, like, if I'm listening to one song that's using the same chord progression, is it invoking my good vibes and memory and feelings of the other songs that I like that have the same chord progression, even though I don't necessarily realize that's why I like it?
Yeah, it's a very tricky place between, you know, being inspired by something, directly copying something, invoking something, or ripping something off. You know, there's a very fine line between like, oh, that song reminds me of this, to, oh, that song is just this, you know?
All right. Evan, you have a quote for us?
Yeah, I do, actually. Here we go. I think the big mistake in schools is trying to teach children anything, and by using fear as the basic motivation. Fear of getting failing grades, fear of not staying with your class, etc. Interest can produce learning on a scale compared to fear as a nuclear explosion to a firecracker. Said by none other than Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, that was
filmmaker,
the exact
photographer and
antithesis of Whiplash.
Yeah, that's the absolute antithesis of the movie Whiplash.
Antithesis, yeah.
Awesome. Which we had an off-air discussion about prior to starting the show, Whiplash.
Well, listen to Geologic Podcast, and George will tell you all about the movie Whiplash and why it was horrible. Now, Evan, are you as much of a Kubrick fan as I am?
No, but I'm a fan. But as much as you are? No, I don't think so.
Probably not.
I'm up there, Steve.
Are you?
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome.
That's
brilliant. Absolutely brilliant director.
We need to talk about Eyes Wide Shut then, Steve, because it's the one part where it gets tough for me.
Absolutely. What do you want to know?
Let me have another special show about it or something, I think. But
On the 10-hour show coming up, we'll talk about it.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, let's do that. That will be perfect. Oh, and speaking of Stanley Kubrick. Did you know that while filming the movie Barry Lyndon in Ireland in 1973, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, placed Kubrick on a hit list, apparently because he was making a film depicting English soldiers on Irish soil. They were none too fond of that idea. And, you know, given the time and the political circumstances of the era, So he actually, at one point, had to kind of pull production out of Ireland and make way for the British mainland in order to, you know, take this threat seriously.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yep.
George, thank you again for joining us. We're going to see you in 2 weeks at Nexus.
Ooh, yeah. Can't wait.
On stage for the extravaganza. And then you're going to join us in the studio for our 10-hour show in May.
Absolutely.
We're looking forward to it.
Can't wait. Can't wait, guys.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks, George.
All right, guys. Bye. Thank you all for joining me this week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.